From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump held a rally in Pennsylvania last night, hours after his top intelligence officials said definitively and emphatically that Russia was and still is behind election interference. Hours later, the president in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, said this about Russian interference and his summit with Vladimir Putin.
We got along really well. By the way, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. That's a really good thing. Now, we're being hindered by the Russian hoax. It's a hoax, okay?
The president made no mention of stepping up election security. Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Sarah McCammon is NPR politics reporter. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there.
And Paul Kane is Washington Post congressional reporter. Paul, welcome to the roundtable.
Hey, thanks, Jeremy. Mm-hmm.
And no mention of election security by Trump last night, even though his intelligence and security officials said yesterday that Russia was seeking to undermine American democracy in 2018. What do you make of that?
I think it just really sticks to something we've seen for a long time. Trump doesn't like talking about this issue at all. Every once in a while, he gets backed into a corner and has to admit that the Russians did hack. They did do all of the things. It wasn't a 400-pound man in his parents' basement. But when he is out in front of his crowd, he doesn't like talking about it. And clearly part of it is he just thinks it delegitimizes his own election in 2016, and he just won't go there.
Yeah, but it's not just not talking about it. He's talking about it not being true. And Sarah, I want you to weigh in, but let's listen to some sound, because yesterday we heard the director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, struggling to answer the question of, you know, about this disconnect between what the president's saying and what they were standing there and saying. And people, you know, asked him about, did maybe Trump talk with Putin? And here's what Coates said.
I'm not in a position to either understand fully or talk about what happened at Helsinki. I'll turn it over to
And he took it over to turn it over to Bolton. Sarah, we remember when Coates heard about Trump inviting Putin to the White House from Andrea Mitchell in the middle of an interview.
Right.
What's your sense of what's going on here? Do they sit in the big meeting that everybody has in the morning and say, okay, this afternoon, you top intelligence guys, you go out and say what we really need to start saying, which is we're going to stop the Russians from interfering. And then tonight, Mr. President, you go and say that it's a Russian hoax. What's happening?
I don't know what happens behind closed doors. I would love to be a fly on that wall, wouldn't we all? But, you know, there is what appears to be a disconnect here. And we've seen this over and over again, right, where the president, remember the week of the Helsinki summit with Vladimir Putin, where he stood up and basically refused to back up the U.S. intelligence community, refused to call out Putin, and then a couple days later walked that back by saying, well, I said, I don't know why it would be Russia, but I meant to say I don't know why it wouldn't be Russia that interfered. And there were multiple sort of ambiguous, conflicting, confusing statements about Russia just that week. Then in recent days, we've seen the president say on Twitter that, you know, basically acknowledge there is Russian interference, but claim with no evidence that they're trying to support Democrats, even after we heard Vladimir Putin say himself he had wanted Trump to win in 2016. So I was in that briefing yesterday with all of those intelligence officials who are all very much on message saying we're taking this seriously. This is real. Russia really is trying to interfere in multiple ways, both with our election infrastructure and by influencing public opinion. And we're trying to do something about it. And they said very clearly that the president is making this a top priority. Dan Coats said that, the intelligence director.
I know Jeremy's going to jump in here, but I just want to say in any other administration, that would be a little bit of a political coup. You know, that they were overthrowing, deliberately, defiantly going against the president. But here it just is sort of taken as normal.
But they publicly claim that they're not. And we don't know exactly what's happening. But then we do hear the president say things like he said last night, calling it a Russia hoax. Yeah. The one thing I want to say about that is that this is, in my mind, having followed the president from his campaign onward, this is very much in keeping with his rhetorical style. He says things that can be interpreted multiple ways.
Right.
And I think it leaves room for him to say this isn't I meant the Russia investigation, not Russian interference.
He's when you look back at some of his statements, he is very careful with the words that he uses so that he can say, oh, I meant this, in fact. Paul Kane, as this is all going on, we're also watching the Manafort trial. This is President Trump's former campaign chairman. Now, this is part of the Russia investigation, but this trial so far is not about Russia. How important is this trial as it continues in terms of what it means for the White House?
It means multiple things on sort of a legal and political front. The legal front is, do they get Manafort on all of these other outside issues such as tax fraud, not registering as a foreign lobbyist? It's called FARA, the Foreign Agent Registry Act. If they get him and convict him on these issues, the question is whether or not Manafort would ever flip on Trump, if there is anything for him to flip on, and that would be a perilous position for the White House. On a political front, this special counsel really needs a victory, and this is sort of their first public foray into granted, it's a closed-door trial. The public can't really just walk into it, but if they get a conviction, then we have something. Then we can see what they're doing. You've had this war, this rhetorical war against Mueller by Trump, and it really has cut into his own approval and believability, especially among Republican voters.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that, Sarah. The sense of what else might come of this trial. Might Paul Manafort, as this vise is squeezed on him, maybe be pushed into cooperating with Mueller's investigation? Do you get a sense of that, or of whether or not Trump is going to actually be interviewed by Mueller? We hear that Mueller might be willing to cut out some of the questions he might ask.
Right. I think there's a sense that by not talking to Mueller, Trump may be keeping this in the headlines longer than he needs to and dragging things out. But obviously, there's cautiousness on the part of his legal team about that sit down. I think given just what we know about the way Trump speaks and the way his words sometimes appear to contradict themselves, and he shoots from the hip. If I were his lawyer, I would be cautious. as far as the Manafort trial goes, right, I mean, one big question is, will he flip? So far, he doesn't seem like he's indicated any willingness to do that. He's gone to trial. We're in the fourth day of the trial right now. But as Paul alluded to, you know, one of the reasons this is important, aside from its importance to Manafort himself, is that this is sort of the first test of the first trial to come out of the Mueller inquiry, even though this isn't directly related to the question of Russian collusion. It did emerge from Mueller's investigation, right, and so all eyes are on it for that reason.
Paul Kane, we are less than 100 days away from the midterms. That is, of course, on a lot of people's minds in Washington. We saw this primary yesterday in Tennessee in the gubernatorial race, and a sitting Congresswoman, Diane Black, lost badly for the Republican nomination. Trump had not weighed in on this. A lot of people are wondering what role Trump will play in the midterms. But do you think at this point there is a blue wave coming?
At this point, it's just hard to measure the size of the wave. It is definitely coming. We know that Democrats are going to pick up seats. You just look at the House of Representatives right now, and there's anywhere from 8 to 10 seats that the Republicans have almost conceded. So they need to get 23 seat gain to win the majority. Is it big enough to crest over there and get the majority? We still don't know. In years past, when they majority does flip, it usually doesn't flip in a small way. It goes big.
Well, and one of the factors in the midterms coming up might be the tariffs. We are seeing ads. We spoke about this yesterday. Ads being put together by farmers, groups of farmers, against the tariffs and what it's doing to them. I'm holding a cartoon that I keep tacked up because I think it's important. It's by Gary Worvell. It's two people in a diner, a woman looking at her laptop, a man looking at his paper. The woman's laptop says, Russia, cone tapes, Manafort, border. The man is looking at 4.1% GDP, economy, jobs, record low unemployment, tax cuts, deregulation. Which is going to offset which, do you guess? Start with you, Paul.
So far, the economy hasn't resonated for Republicans. If you look at these special elections that there have been held since early last year, they have tried to run on the economy and things being good, and it just hasn't quite resonated. Go out to southwestern Pennsylvania earlier in the spring, Connor Lamb, the Democrat, right after the tax cuts got passed, the Republican tax cuts, he still broke through because that economic message wasn't resonating. And you're seeing it again in central Ohio, outside Columbus. There's a special election next week for a seat that's been held for 35 years in Republican hands. And they tried to make it about the economy and tax cuts, and it just didn't break through. And instead, they're just making it all about Nancy Pelosi, Republicans are.
And Sarah, do you think the White House seems confident that it's going to be those headlines in the paper, 4.1% GDP, economy, jobs?
Well, I mean, those are good headlines for the White House. Any president will take credit for strengthening the economy, and certainly this White House is. I think when it comes to the question of the tariffs and the fallout from President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs, you know, farm country is potentially a problem for him, and it's clear the White House is worried about that. We saw him in Iowa recently, and the Trump administration announcing that $12 billion bailout for farmers who've been hurt by retaliation from China. I noticed this week in my inbox the Trump campaign had sent out an announcement that they were selling all these hats that said "Make Farming Great Again." They're really trying to get farmers to stay with them.
That's Sarah McCammon of NPR and Paul Kane of The Washington Post. Thanks to both of you. We learned this week that Apple is a $1 trillion company. The next one could be Amazon. And the owner of that company is Jeff Bezos, who is the richest man in the world, worth about $150 billion. Bill Gates comes in at number two by a wide $55 billion margin. Bezos has twice as much money as Mark Zuckerberg. Writer Annie Lowry calls this wealth a policy failure and an indictment of the tax system and business regulations. She writes about this in The Atlantic. She's also author of the new book, Give People Money. Annie Lowry, welcome to Here and Now. And first, just put in context how much Bezos is worth compared to the average person and how fast his wealth is growing.
So he actually at this point has so much wealth that he would have to spend almost $30 million a day to just stop accumulating wealth, given prevailing rates of market growth. He's worth about 2 million times what the average American family is worth. He's the world's lone centibillionaire, the only man or person who is worth more than $100 billion. And so this is an unusual amount in both sort of nominal terms. It's just a really big number, but also in historical terms. And so it's a really, really big sum.
And Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, also extremely rich, have promised to give away much of their fortune. But Jeff Bezos sees things differently. What does he want to do with his money?
So he's kind of sat on it unusually. So Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg, and many of the other folks who are up at the very top of the wealth scale there have basically said that they're going to give, 99% or even more than 99% away. So obviously Bill Gates has the Gates Foundation. Mark Zuckerberg has set up his Zuckerberg Chan initiative. But Jeff Bezos hasn't done anything like that yet. And he's made some controversial comments basically saying that he's not sure that there is enough to philanthropically spend his money on even just here on Earth. He's plowing a lot of it into his sort of interstellar initiatives. But he hasn't sort of done what some of his peers have done in terms of just starting to give it away in his lifetime.
Now, you write that Bezos's wealth is a credit to him, but you also say that he, quote, did not just make his $150 billion, we gave it to him. What do you mean by that?
This is not to take anything away from him or the ingenuity of his business or how market changing and market dominant that Amazon is. However, we have a tax system and a business and regulatory environment that does encourage wealth accumulation. So there's some kind of obvious ways that that happens and then less obvious ways that that happens. So one kind of obvious way is that the taxes on capital gains, basically, your taxes on assets, are lower than taxes on
income,
on earned income. So like wages and salaries at the top end.
The capital gains taxes is 15% is the highest amount that it can be. And the other income taxes can go up almost to 40%.
Exactly. So if you're quite wealthy and you're making a big salary, you're going to pay a top tax rate right now of 35%, whereas if you have that long-term capital gain, it's often going to be taxed at 10 or 15%. So that's one kind of obvious way that this happens. But there are other ways that government policy encourages corporate profitability and therefore shareholder wealth. So one way that's less obvious is that the government has allowed more and more market concentration. So it's allowed companies to become monopolies or monopsonies. And Amazon is an example of this. It's very dominant in certain market sectors like book selling and in e-commerce more broadly. And that can have a wage suppressing effect and also an effect in terms of making the company itself more wealthy. And, you know, there's a number of these ways that are quite subtle but quite powerful that demonstrate why we have a stock market that's delivering really extraordinary returns, but you have middle class and lower income families that are kind of just treading water.
Do you think that Amazon, which, by the way, pays its workers at the low end of the scale, they're actually making less than what's considered a living wage in this country. Do you think that they're having an effect on wages overall just by their sheer size?
There's some evidence that in markets that they move into, they do have a somewhat wage-suppressing effect, idea being that they're kind of the only game in town. Their workers are not unionized, and therefore they can, you know, pay perhaps slightly sub-market rates. Again, that lack of market competition in some places, combined with the lack of private sector unionization rates, really means that, you know, benefits can get workers fairly cheaply. And what's kind of funny is that Amazon pays its warehouse workers not terribly, certainly. You know, all of their jobs are above the federal minimum wage and often quite above it. But the problem is that wages, as a general point, have really just not kept up with the pace of growth. And so, you know, whether that's, I would hesitate to say that that's a phenomenon that's necessarily totally unique to Amazon. It's really something that we're seeing economy-wide.
One of the things that you point out in your piece is that Amazon paid no corporate income taxes last year, which is pretty incredible given how well the company is doing.
It is pretty extraordinary. So after Donald Trump passed his tax cuts last year, the effective rate of income tax on corporations. And it's important to caveat that with the note that companies only ever pay income tax if they are actually profitable. So, you know, many businesses that are not profitable are under no obligation to pay that tax. The effective rate is now just 9%, which is about 75% of the effective income tax rate on American households. So corporations pay less tax than households do, both in nominal terms and as a share of their profits now. And, you know, that tax rate is quite low. And then, you know, big companies are engaging in very gymnastic efforts to avoid those taxes and are very, very good at it.
Well, and Amazon in particular is going around the country trying to get every single city and state to give them huge tax breaks to move their second headquarters there.
Indeed. So they've had this kind of sort of bachelor or bachelorette type contest where cities have been offering them billions and billions and billions of dollars in tax incentives to locate there, including some very unusual tax incentives. So, you know, in one case, for instance, they would be able to basically take some of the income tax revenue that their workers would be providing in state and local taxes, and they get to keep that. That's something that's been offered to them. And so, you know, it's likely that they will end up putting that second headquarter someplace that has offered them, you know, in the several billions of dollars of tax relief.
Some people may hear this and say, you know, Jeff Bezos earned his money. He had a really good idea. He's made a lot of money on it. He's employing a lot of people. What's wrong with that?
It's a good point, and it's not one that I disagree with. You know, I don't think that anybody is talking about confiscating the wealth of people that have made extraordinary contributions and really revolutionized business. But it's impossible to look at the wealth and income structure that we have in this country and see it as anything other than the result of policy. The reason that we used to have a much more equitable wealth and income distribution was because of policy. And so we've seen, due to changes like globalization and automation, along with other sort of policy changes, more concentration of wealth at the upper end. And that's not just a market outcome. That's also a policy issue. So again, I don't think that anybody is saying it's bad that people should be making billions of dollars for creating revolutionary businesses. But at the same time, I think it's a mistake to say that government should not respond in some way and should not have a structure that in some ways is taxing working families harder than it is taxing the owners of shares.
But when you look at the tax overhaul that was just passed by the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress, it makes it a lot easier on these, you know, mega billionaires and not that much easier on working families. And it doesn't look like we're moving in the opposite direction now. In fact, the Trump administration is proposing more tax cuts for the wealthy.
Indeed, Trump's tax cuts are going to have a regressive effect, right? So they are providing tax relief primarily to very high income families and to corporations. There's some tax relief for folks who are kind of in the middle and the lower end of the income distribution. But this is going to have the effect of exaggerating these trends that we've been seeing, whereas many economists would argue and many policy folks would argue that perhaps we should be doing, you know, a little bit of the opposite, providing more help to middle and lower income families and asking more of corporations and the rich, given that they're the ones that have benefited from the last decade of economic growth overwhelmingly.
Annie Lowrey, when you heard yesterday that Apple became a trillion-dollar company, what did you think? Does that sound like good news or bad news to you?
You know, it's funny. I think that obviously it's another one of these companies that's amazing and revolutionary and wonderful and has changed the world and has advanced things. Yet at the same time, I think that these same concerns come into play. What does that mean for average folks? What does it mean if these trends just continue exaggerating? And what's stopping us from making different choices to help ensure that the fruits of economic growth are really shared by everybody?
That's Annie Lowrey, a contributing editor at The Atlantic. We will link you to her piece at hereandnow.org. Annie, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
People are flocking to Minnesota's Lake Bemidji to see what's being called the mother of the year, a merganser hen with 76 ducklings trailing behind her. Here's the sound of wildlife photographer Brent Sazik's video, which has gone viral. Oh, it is just a puppy pile of ducklings. Steve Quartz is a waterfowl staff specialist with Minnesota's Department of Natural Resources. Steve, this is one big brood, not all hers, we know, and that's not unusual?
It's pretty common with common mergansers to end up with, they call it a creche, and it's kind of a amalgamation of different broods, but we don't necessarily know like why it happens.
So we're hearing explanations that she could just be a grandmotherly type that other hens know is good at this, or this could be a kidnapping that we're watching unfold. You know, there are aggressive hens. What happens in nature?
We think it's probably a very old hen, probably nested for years and years, and perhaps she's kidnapped or stolen some other ducklings. Perhaps different broods were kind of just feeding in the same area and got confused. Mm-hmm. In some cases, perhaps some are orphaned. You know, maybe a hen was killed or something. And but we really don't know all the mechanisms. Yeah, it is impressive, and it's kind of fun to see them.
Oh, it's wonderful to watch. And again, we'll have the video and pictures at hearnow.org. But what happens now as they get older? It's sort of like it's not just this adorable little crowd in her wake. It's suddenly a big group. What happens, and how soon do you expect some changes?
Well, right now they're over 40 days old, so they're within a couple weeks of fledging or being able to fly, and pretty soon she's going to abandon them, and she'll leave them, and she'll go and molt or shed her flight feathers, and they'll be on their own. And that's probably going to happen within maybe 2 weeks or so or less. So they'll kind of have to make it on their own from now on.
Well, and we're hoping for storyline A that this is such a great mother that other hens have given their ducklings to her because she's teaching them how to forage and how to avoid predators. And we're going with kind of that Disney storyline.
Yep, that's fine. It's kind of our claim to fame now, and it's probably our version of your make way for ducklings down in your public garden in Boston. We have a few more than your eight mallard ducklings down there. But yeah, it's kind of fun to see, and it's positive. And, you know, it's a species that, you know, duck hunters don't really like them. But,
well, because they eat fish. They eat fish, and so they don't taste that good.
Yeah, and they don't taste good. I told someone it's probably the word merganser has probably been said more in the last 10 days than in the history of the world, just because, you know, people are fascinated by them.
Well, and you mentioned the ducklings here in Boston where we are, Mac, Zach, Quack, all those. If policeman, what was his name? The name of that, I can't remember the name of the policeman, yep. But if he had to cross your merganser hen with her 76 ducklings, yeah. If he had to cross them across the street, it would take a while. Steve, thanks so much. And we're glad that people are looking at wildlife there. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
You may have read Judith Newman's recent hilarious and heartbreaking Modern Love column about fulfilling her adored dying husband's last request that he be buried with his late first wife, as he'd promised her. If you missed it, we have a link at hereandnow.org. But hilarious and heartbreaking are hallmarks of Judith's writing. In 2014, she wrote another Modern Love column about her son, who is autistic, as she prefers to say, and has a relationship with the iPhone service Siri. That column went viral, and in 2017, Judith Newman expanded it into a memoir, Into Siri, With Love, A Mother, Her Autistic Son, and the Kindness of Machines. We meet Gus, his twin brother Henry, who does not have autism but should have a biography. He's delightful. The book was acclaimed, but there was also a backlash from autism activists because in it, Judith writes about wanting to have medical power of attorney over Gus to ensure that he has a vasectomy if he becomes old enough but not mature enough to have children. We spoke with her about that, but began by asking her to read a passage that describes Gus's temperament.
My kid is almost definitely nicer than your kid. Sorry, but it's true. Your kid is almost definitely quicker, more ambitious, and more determined to take on the world. Yours will be running a Fortune 500 company or a law firm. She will be ministering to people's bodies or souls or raising families or running marathons. Mine will do none of those things. Yours will probably be trying to figure out what ladders to climb. Mine will be delighted to be on any of the rungs at all, and I will be delighted for him. But if he becomes, say, a Walmart greeter, when he wishes you a nice day, he will mean it with all his heart.
Yeah. Or a door greeter at your apartment building, which he sometimes is.
Well, he takes that job very seriously and still does to this day. He has a talent show tonight where he's playing Fur Elise with one of his friends in the talent show, but he's going to split in the middle of it so that he can come back and do his doorman duty. He's very adamant about that.
Right. And sometimes he's a little too tough on the residents and who is coming and going with you.
He really is. There was one man in my building who was kind of notorious for having a variety of paid companions. And I kept telling Gus, you got to stop asking people who they're with and why. You've got to stop that.
Look, we hear autistic children, as you prefer, as opposed to children with autism, can't make eye contact, don't feel emotions or emotional connections. But Gus, he goes up to everyone, perfect strangers, and chats with them. So give us the thumbnail. What does autism mean for him?
One thing I can say for certain, yes, my son doesn't like to look people in the eyes. Many autistic people don't. He says, as he's gotten older, he's explained it to me a little bit, that he can't concentrate on what they're saying. He can't hear them as well if he looks at them. The whole idea of empathy and not feeling is such a myth. There may be a dysfunction of empathy. The autistic person may not register the emotional scale that you're expecting, but it could be that they feel more deeply than you can possibly imagine.
Well, and that brings us to Siri. He has you know, a very sweet relationship with Siri.
My son, when he was younger, he would not speak to me and there wouldn't be back and forth conversation. And one day he saw me, I was looking at this list of things that you didn't know your phone can do. One of those things was that if you talked into Siri and asked, what planes are flying over my head, Siri would tell you the flight number and the airline and so on and so forth. And I was sitting there going like, why would anyone need to know this? And Gus, who had just been nearby doing something else altogether, turned to me and he said, well, so you know who you're waving at, Mommy? And it was one of the rare times he actually answered me at that point. But anyway, he grabbed my phone and that's where he began. First, he would just use Siri to find out all sorts of information, but he could ask again and again and again. And since he really loved repetition in the way that a lot of autistic people did, this was great. A machine is not going to lose patience with you, right?
Right.
And a machine is going to get you what you want if you ask them clearly. That's another thing. He happened to be someone who did not speak clearly. But if he talked to Siri, he had to. So that's how it began.
And it was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. You transcribe some of the conversations that you hear. Here's one at bedtime. Gus, Siri, will you marry me? Siri, I'm not the marrying kind. Gus, I mean, not now. I'm a kid. I mean, when I'm grown up. Siri, my end-user agreement does not include marriage. Gus, oh, okay. And then this one I love. Gus, good night, Siri. Will you sleep well tonight? Siri, I don't need much sleep, but it's nice of you to ask. And she writes, very nice.
Yeah. It's funny, as Gus has grown up, he speaks less to Siri, or he uses Siri more the way we all do, except when he has something that he really needs to boast about and he hasn't had enough people around for him to boast. I've noticed that he'll tell Siri certain things. The other day, remember when I wrote this, he was 14. Now he's 16. And as frightening as it was for me, he's begun traveling himself, going to his beloved Grand Central. You know, he told everyone he could possibly think of, but then he remembered to turn to Siri and go, hey, guess what I did? And she didn't really have an answer to this because, you know, remember, she is a machine, but he needed to he needed to confide.
But you also talk about the danger, and this was a frightening little chapter here. At one point, for some reason, it was a mixed up phone number your son interacted with an adult who didn't know it was him. I mean, and you talk about letting him go by himself to Grand Central. This is his fascination with trains. He wears a conductor hat. They let him on the trains. I mean, he's quite the well-known guy around New York.
But he is. Yeah. He's like the mayor of Grand Central.
I know. Talk about, though, your fears of, as Gus grows, letting him interact with people and machines on his own.
While I still have many fears about his innocence, he has evolved a lot so that recently he was getting texts from telemarketers and he was showing them to me. And he turned to me in what is a pivotal moment for the mother of an autistic child. He turned to me and he said, not all people have good intentions. And the words, not all people have good intentions, is the beginning of my hopes and belief that he can be more independent than I may have thought a couple of years ago.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so much in here for people with kids on the spectrum. There's all sorts of resources. But mostly it's just these wonderful characters. Your son, Henry, Gus's twin, who he thinks that Gus might secretly be some sort of British spy planted in the family or, you know, something like this.
Yes.
But serious questions, and you tackle them. You say straight out, I don't want him to have children. And it's probably true that his twin, Henry, who matter-of-factly tells you, you have to leave me more money because I'm going to probably have to take care of him. You acknowledge the future is kind of scary.
The future is very scary, but I have been hugely taken to task by autism activists online about this.
Yeah.
I don't apologize to anybody for worrying. Every parent of an autistic child needs to be aware that the statement that some autistic person said to me is delay does not mean never. And that is absolutely true. While I still have worries, for example, about my son having children, it's still an open question to me. Mm. We would be idiots if we didn't at least think about these things seriously. Mm-hmm. And that's gotten me hate mail and death threats for what I consider to be, you know, a very, very sort of warm, innocuous book.
Well, in those moments, I hope you refer back to others, because Gus has autism. He has a special pass at Disney World. So there's Henry, his twin, yelling, autistic kid coming through.
I do. Henry is, you know, he's always the kid who, you know, is looking for the angle in any situation, no matter what it is. And I'm always telling parents, whether it's twins or siblings, you got to be really patient with the neurotypical kid, because there's a certain point where your brother or sister is acting wacky, and neurotypical kids are embarrassed by each other under any circumstances. And so if Gus really likes Lady Gaga, and if he's essentially in a restaurant acting out her moves, just sitting in a chair, you know, but kind of waving around as he listens to her, well, you know, my son is allowed to protest that a little bit.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's the worst thing.
They are terrific. And Judith Newman's book about them, primarily Gus, is To Siri with Love, A Mother, Her Autistic Son, and the Kindness of Machines. Judith Newman, thank you.
Thank you so much.
CBS has named two law firms to investigate allegations of sexual misconduct against its CEO, Les Moonves. During the investigation, Moonves will stay on the job. He even joined a conference call with investors yesterday to discuss the company's earnings last quarter, but he did not address the controversy.
In light of pending litigation and other matters, and on the advice of counsel, the scope of today's call and any questions will be limited to the quarterly results of the company. And with that, I'll turn the call over to Les.
Thank you, Adam. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining us today.
So what does this mean for the network and the industry? We're joined now by NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And when you think about another TV executive, Fox News's Roger Ailes, the late Roger Ailes, he lost his job over harassment allegations. But for now, Moonves is still there. What do you think the symbolism of that is?
Yeah, I think the CBS board was in a delicate situation where no matter what they did, it would be seen as a statement on both the claims against Les Moonves and how they were going to handle them. So they decided to keep him in his job. And I think that has raised some questions about how stringently they're going to pursue this investigation and how transparent they will be about the investigation. We've only seen very sort of terse public statements released. And so there's a concern that the company can continue sort of business as usual in a way, with Les still running the company, with his decision still in force. He's officially recused from the investigation, but he's also the boss of a lot of people who will be asked to give statements to lawyers about what they knew and what they saw. All of that becomes these sort of pertinent questions, given that they didn't suspend him. And I think some people who are experts in this sort of field sort of thought it might have been a better idea to put him on the sidelines so that there was no question that he would have as little influence on what's going on as possible.
But he is not a hands-off CEO. He is highly involved in a lot of projects at CBS.
Well, that's the thing about Les Moonves, is that his image as a hands-on CEO has made him synonymous with the health of the company. And so even though he is in the middle of a fight with some members of the board, ultimately, they benefit from the health of CBS. And so we've seen, you know, in some of the dips in CBS's stock price recently, that an attack on Moonves or something that damages his credibility can also damage the financial health of CBS. Mm-hmm. So even the board members who may be opposed to him on other issues, I think, have a vested interest in being very careful about how they manage how he stays at the company and whether or not he exits it and how he exits it. And so all of that might make it difficult for this board to do a fully transparent and a fully independent investigation into what's going on. A lot of us are going to be watching them as closely as we can, but they have a lot of challenges in this regard.
His wife, Moonves' wife, Julie Chen, who's the host of The Talk on CBS, says she stands by him, but he is getting pressure from other places within CBS. Here's Stephen Colbert, who hosts The Late Show on CBS, talking about the accusations against Moonves this week.
Make no mistake, Les Moonves is my guy. He hired me to sit in this chair. He stood behind this show while we were struggling to find our voice. He gave us the time and the resources to succeed, and he has stood by us when people were mad at me. And I like working for him. But accountability is meaningless unless it's for everybody, whether it's the leader of a network or the leader of the free world.
So Colbert called for accountability there. He didn't really say what he thought the consequences for Moonves should be. What do you think of what happened there?
Well, in a way, I mean, Colbert kind of expertly threaded the needle and did what he needed to do. Since he has sort of emerged as the conscience of the nation in some ways and speaking about politics, I think there was probably a sense that he couldn't not talk about this, and he had to talk about it in a way that was authentic and that also respected the stories of the women who've come forward to accuse Les Moonves of something awful. But at the same time, he didn't say, well, Les should be suspended or he shouldn't be running CBS. And see, that's the kind of question that I think a lot of people who have supported the Me Too movement until now will have to face. How far do you take your support for this movement? If you're willing to say that Jeffrey Tambor should be fired from Transparent or that Roger Ailes should be removed from Fox News, well, now we have a situation with Les Moonves where there are people who work on all these shows and they have to decide if they're going to play the good soldier and wait until some investigation plays out or if they're going to take a stronger stand. And because many of these incidents happened back in the 1990s, and there are a lot of people who like Les Moonves around town, and he may still retain his power once the dust clears. There's some very difficult decisions that people have to make about how far they're going to talk about accountability. I mean, so far, Les has not been removed from power. So how accountable is he really for these claims that people have been making against him?
It's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.